Africans at home and throughout the diaspora. Unity is strength. We've got to go.
Nothing but the land of fighting. Now we've got to do the right thing.
We need more unity.
Stop the fussing and the fighting. Now we've got to do the right thing.
Give the spirit of umoja and praise with love.
Let's do it right now. We've got to do it right. Stop the fussing and the fighting.
Right now.
Now we've got to do the right thing. Let's do it right now. We've got to do it right.
Right now.
Yes, yes, this is Jamala Rogers, your host of Voices from the Battlefield, and we are going to be trying to do it right. We are going to struggle to do it right. We're going to strive to do it right, because 2025 is ours for the taking. And so we are here because Voices from the Battlefield connects, you know, people who are struggling all over the country, in fact, sometimes all over the world, and they are fighting for democracy, fighting for economic justice, for political power. And those battlefields can be very, very different. It can be about housing, police accountability, healthcare, education. There are so many struggles that we can connect with. And what we want to do here is to show you that our struggle is not in isolation. There are people doing the same thing, feeling the same thing, experiencing the same thing, but all about organizing to get self-determination and dignity. So we have, something that we want to bring to you today that has, you know, some controversy, but, you know, we want to say, first of all, that we are live from Harrisville State University, and we are here at the host of Black Radio Hall of Fame. Our, you know, beautiful, beautiful Black institutions. And we also want to say that, you know, the comments on this show are not necessarily those of Harrisville State University or Black Radio Hall of Fame. So, you know, we're just going to dive right into our guest. We have one today, Johnson Lancaster, and you've heard from Johnson before, and only because he is a person that can really take on and tackle many different issues. But today we're going to be tackling abolition. And both Johnson and I are members of the steering committee for the Coalition Against Police Crimes and Repression. This is a group that's been around since 1983, that led the fight for local control of the St. Louis Police Department, bringing that back home, and also to establish our first independent civilian oversight board, which has gone through their various struggles, and we could talk about that too. But welcome to the show, Johnson.
Thank you for the invite. You know, it's always wonderful that we're able to have a platform to explore these issues.
Absolutely. And when we think about abolition, I think the term might have come, you know, post George Floyd, but I think people, out of frustration, keep looking at the police departments across the country and know that they aren't about solving crime. They aren't about doing all the things that we normally think they are about. And particularly in Black and brown communities, it's really about occupation and control. So, you know, people start to look at what else is out there. What else can we do? And there's always an alternative. And so those are the things that we've been exploring. So I want you to talk a bit about what Coalition, and from here on we'll say CAPCAR because that's the shortened version of that whole Coalition Against Police Crimes and Repression, but we want people to know what that means, because what it means is exactly what we've been doing for the past, you know, 40 plus years. Talk about abolition and what CAPCAR has been doing around the process of getting people to understand abolition.
Well, it's interesting how this term, abolition, evolved. Because you know, we can hearken back to the time when African people were enslaved in the United States, and abolition referred to the ending of enslavement. But more broadly and more recently, abolition has referred to the ending of oppression by law enforcement, state-sanctioned oppression, state-sanctioned brutality and extrajudicial murder by law enforcement. We sought to stop it and to enact some reforms that would rein in really out of control law enforcement. So what some people try to say is defund the police is not necessarily defunding the police, but more so making police more accountable for their action and recognizing that there are times when police don't necessarily need to be brought into certain types of situations like mental health episodes and certain types of domestic conflicts and even times when folks get on 911 and complain about other types of things that don't necessarily rise to the level of having a police response. Now, certainly there's a role for law enforcement in the prevention of certain types of crimes. But like, say, the African American Police Officers Association says that they're actually in the business of being officers of the peace, keeping the peace, not necessarily law enforcement. You know, certainly it's the color of law that governs their ability to keep the peace. But it's a different perspective, a different mindset, because we don't necessarily have to resort to levels of force that go from, I guess, if there's such a thing as mild force, to then there's excessive force, and then there's lethal force. And so part of what we've been attempting to do with the Coalition of Police Against Police Crimes and Repression is to place in context what levels of force are appropriate or what levels of force are inappropriate when they're interacting with the community that they're supposed to protect and serve.
So before we get to the particulars of it, I do want to add that abolition for us is a process, but ultimately abolition means the end to policing, courts, and prisons. So that's the broad sort of framework that when people say they are abolitionists, they're either coming from it from the standpoint of, you know, police, courts, or prisons. And so for us, it's about police, because obviously Coalition Against Police Crimes and Repression. Mm-hmm. But the end goal is the end to these inherently racist institutions. But I think the thing that confuses people, they think we mean like overnight, immediate. And for Black folks in particular, I don't know about brown folks, white folks, but, you know, they start to shudder without an alternative. So who do they call if there's an actual crime? Mm-hmm. So we've been trying to fill in those particular questions. But ultimately, we say if we do the work right, if we make sure that folks have what they need, crime will ultimately be reduced, and that which is left, we don't need police officers responding to that, because as Alex Vitale told us, you know, when he came here in his book Ending of Policing, that they really aren't the people to do that. They really aren't the folks to be responding to the reasons people call the police. And they definitely, as we see with the 1,000 homicides, they definitely aren't, you know, investigating and resolving crimes and homicides. So then what are they there for? And I know for CAPCAR and many other organizations like ours, we have gone to how the police evolved, and they actually evolved out of slavery in terms of, you know, slave catchers. And so we believe that there's no redemption for that, and the way that they are entrenched now, there's no reform of that system. I'm talking about policing in particular. So we are starting from that standpoint, that what do we do to get us to the end of policing, is Alex Vitale. And that's not black folks saying that. That's a white author saying that the end of policing is possible and relevant. And so I think from that standpoint, CAPCAR has been doing some things to really re-educate people, rethink, what it could look like, what our communities could look like if we re-envision public safety. So maybe we should have started with the campaign that we created post Michael Brown and the Ferguson uprising, that we need a different way of looking at policing, and not just policing, but public safety. Because often our people equate our police with feeling more safe, and we know that that's not the case.
That is definitely not the case. When you look at it with the integral elements of the incarceration and the judicial system, you know, the prosecution of cases and the adjudicating of people after they've been criminalized, this is all part of a crazy quilt of state-sanctioned oppression, more in service of those who control property and power and wealth. And so, those who don't have any property and power and wealth are victimized by that. And especially the dissenters of the system, where we're saying that there are some civil liberties that are being trampled upon and need to be, addressed. So then we have these allies, not people of color, who recognize that this state-sanctioned oppression is something that needs to be addressed across the board. And that's why they're starting to step into the fray with this. Now, we have been at the vanguard and forefront of it as a people ever since we fought against our bondage. And you bring a great point that the first police force in the city of St. Louis was actually slave patrollers who were deputized by those who held us in bondage to maintain a certain level of control over us. And that control extended into when the so-called police force was, unquote, professionalized as the city finalized its borders and became more urbanized, and the rich class began to generate the wealth and commerce that helped to make St. Louis the city it is today. So these questions of class and questions of freedom for the masses have always been in conflict, on a collision course. And as a result, we've had to try to be the ones who are bigger than the overall situation and set forth alternatives to state sanctioned oppression.
Right. So, you know, when we talk about abolition, we really are talking about, we're fighting for a world where the response to social problems is not going to include prisons, policing, prosecution, or any forms of surveillance, supervision, or incarceration. And I think that's got to be what people understand about abolition. So we believe that we can have a civil society without these particular institutions. And one actually helps the other. So they're overlapping. So we may not be necessarily dealing with prison, but if we stop the flow of folks that the police are stopping and you know, pushing into the court system, then ultimately it's going to impact the end thing, and that's when people are actually sentenced and then they're incarcerated. So these three things are working together. Our focus is on the police. And so one of the things, Johnson, that, you know, we've been doing for all year, we've been, political education has been around becoming abolition. And that's by Derrica Purnell. And she is a St. Louis citizen who, you know, was able to go off to, law school. And so, she came back during Ferguson and got to see firsthand, like, how police were responding. And so she began to rethink her own position about abolition. And so that's the journey that she talks about in her book, Become an Abolitionist. But just recently, Philip McHarris has released a book called, but it's about the ending police. That's pretty straightforward. Ending police, where he talks about how you do that, who's been trying to do it around the country. And I, you know, one of the things that we found out when we started our political education here locally around Derrica's book is that, you know, although the defund the police and the abolitionist cry got a lot of media attention, there were few communities that were actually doing it, actually trying to make it happen. And so for us, we realized that the education process has to be in place. And so we started to read Derrica's book and have discussions about it. And each one of those would also include, like, how would that look here in St. Louis? So we're finished with that series now. We finished with the political education. And that next meeting, we'll incorporate what we've learned from other resources and experiences to say, how will it look here? And for us, we've started to look at the police budget. Oftentimes, Jocelyn, you know, there's people will talk the talk, but then there's no alignment. So we've heard mayors, we've heard police chiefs, and I would say both the police chiefs and mayors here have said this: you can't arrest your way out of crime. Okay, if you believe that, then why is one-third of our city budget going to that unsuccessfully?
Absolutely.
So we've been making that case. We've been making that case with looking at the budget, looking at how much is spent, looking at, you know, the fact that the crime rates, you know, people still didn't feel safe. So what is this really about? So I think that, you know, I'm excited about what we are going to be talking about, what it's going to look like. But the budget, man, when we look at that budget and we start looking at all the things that are under public safety, and maybe you could just go through that. What the public safety budget for the city of St. Louis includes what?
It includes the police department, fire department, emergency management agency, the court, and affiliated fees around that, public defender, prosecutor, probation and parole, and correction. So that some of the funding comes from the state level and some of it comes out of the city of St. Louis's budget. So, and we've called this, collectively, we've called it the criminal injustice complex. Other thing.
Yeah.
But, I mean, this is a vast kind of thing. The city of St. Louis supposedly has many more police per capita city, a similar city its size and population. So series of different police chiefs over time to say that we need more police doesn't pan out because St. Louis seems to already be over police.
See, Johnson, that's the exact thing that I think you have to include in a public education campaign, because people will say, because they're hearing it from a police chief, we need more police. The reason that there's all this crime is because we need more police. Well, if you say we already have enough police and you still hollering about you can't cover the areas, then what, something else is wrong. It's not numerically we need more. And I think that goes to exactly the crux of why people need to be educated and not just parrot what they hear somebody of authority saying, because these folks got a self-interest. They got to keep the budget. They got to keep those folks getting that overtime. And meanwhile, some of those other social problems that we know exist, that they say you can't arrest your way out of, they don't get the budgetary needs that would at least alleviate some of it, not completely end it, but at least alleviate. So when you think about how big that department is, and we just saw a protest, and some of us were involved in that, the protest of killings at the city jail, that jail is up under that money. And so how are we saying that money is used if we've had a whole year and a half of people dying at the jail and with no resolution? I mean, people are really tired of that. I can't say it any other word. They're pissed about it.
At some point, it becomes a self-perpetuating system.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Okay, that provides jobs and economic development. Why you see the proliferation of private prisons, proliferation of corporations that manage these private prisons, how states across the country are building correctional centers in rural areas. And those correctional centers in rural areas are magnets of economic development for those areas. They provide jobs for the folks that are struggling in the agricultural sector have not necessarily well educated and still to take care of their families. So then what happens is that, you know, the arrest, prosecution and incarceration model becomes a business model that self-perpetuates and affects people, you know, in the economically deprived, lower educated, stricken class in the country. Fortunately, you know, those of us who can't afford a good lawyer to get out of a problem, afford bail to get us out of jail while we're waiting for our case to be adjudicated, there are real issues. But the complex, the criminal injustice complex, is still perpetuating.
Absolutely, absolutely. And so when I think about people, this is another point of education. People seem to think that the folks in the city jail have been convicted. No, these are people waiting to have their case heard. So, you know, we live in a system that's supposed to be you innocent until proven guilty, but yet we have people there in that hellhole and some of them actually dying. Now, who thinks about being a casualty, a tragedy, if you went in there because of an administrative snafu that has you not paying your ticket and you get picked up? I mean, really? This is like some kind of abomination, but I think it speaks to why we need to totally be about understanding how these different institutions, as you said, feed each other and a part of a business model that is making billions of dollars, billions each year, not just from local, but, you know, when you look at the jails, prisons and all of it. It's a nice little industry that you can go in and make money, but that's not what we want to be happening off our people's back and off our people's tax dollars. So that's why this issue is so important. Can you talk a little bit about what, talked about jail, but we also know that some of those people, and you almost touched on it and I thought you were going to say it. Some of these people are in there, but need to get out. They need to get out to a job, to their family. So what do they do?
Bargain, yes.
And so when you talk about the perpetuation of the system, this is part of that. Now you got a record, right? You said,
right.
I didn't do it, but I don't have money for an attorney. I got to get back to work. And now you part of a system and you also a statistic.
And you're caught up. Now you have to, you know, visit a parole officer, a probation officer, on a periodic basis. You might have an ankle bracelet.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
mm-hmm.
you might have to go to some classes, some mandated classes.
Mm.
And if you miss a class or a treatment program, you know, session, you know, you might be in violation of your probation and parole.
Right.
You know?
So
yeah, the battery on your ankle bracelet dies, and you don't charge. You forget to charge it.
Mm. Yeah.
and they can't track you. You might be in violation of your situation.
Yeah. So I mean, this is exactly how it gets perpetuated. I mean, I just think that people, once they know the information, particularly if they know a loved one who had to go through that, know that that system is unjust, unfair, and it's totally a reckless system. Because how do you get in there in the first place? Sometimes it's by an administrative, you know, slip up. And then we think about people who have died based on not getting the medication
medical treatment.
Yeah. How is that happening when you're supposed to do an intake that lets you know this person needs their medicine, they have diabetes, they got insulin, and yet you don't give them medication?
Institutional indifference and institutional systemic neglect. In actuality, it amounts to cruel and inhumane punishment.
Absolutely. And there's some lawsuits against that jail for exactly that reason.
Absolutely. So another thing. Okay. So say you're a homeowner and you're a senior citizen and you have code violations. Okay, if you don't address the code violations, then you'll be given a summons to appear in court. And then, and if you miss the court date, then a warrant will be placed for your arrest.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
You know? Or if you do go to court and you don't have money to address the code violations, then you have fines. Mm-hmm. All part of the system. The criminal justice complex. You could have caught up, like you say, it doesn't necessarily have to be criminal or misdemeanor type stuff. It could be administrative.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and you get caught up.
And literally, so, when I think about that, Johnson, we went to a brother that got locked up. We were locked up too. And when I'm saying we, members of the Coalition Against Police Crimes and Repression, during really trying to make a case for bringing local control back to St. Louis. And so we did some civil disobedience. And so we got arrested. There was a brother in the van with us who had his, it ain't funny, really. He had his robe on and house shoes. He said he was cooking his lunch and he wanted a soda and he was out of soda. So he's going to walk down to the confectionery and get him a soda. So he really didn't change clothes. And I'd be damned if he didn't get picked up for a warrant, an outstanding warrant. And according to him, he had paid his ticket, but apparently it didn't get registered. So here he is, food left on the table, him in his house shoes and house coat, and he's going to jail with us. So when I think about those kind of snafus, it was probably a mistake on the part of the institution, but he ended up paying for that, you know, in many different ways. And so when I think about what kind of system that we want until we get to abolition, that's what I think we encourage people to think about. What should the police department look like if you get a ticket or if you are wrongfully accused of a crime? What should the prosecutor's office look like? What should, if, forbid, if you have to go to prison, what kind of conditions do you think should be there? And so I think when people start to reimagine that from a personal standpoint, then they get to see like what things we need to be doing now to address those issues. So
because at some level, there are certain things that just need to be decriminalized and handled in an administrative way. As bringing to bear some kind of arrest, prosecution, incarceration model.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you certainly move certain types of quote unquote offenses, you know, out of that realm, and have, you know, allow government to handle it some other kind of way.
And it makes me think about when there was the sweep across the nation to reform prosecutors. Part of that agenda that we had them agree to, and that's both for the prosecutors, city and county here, you know, not to prosecute some of those crimes, like you said, marijuana, child support, women seeking abortion. You know, some of these things that would criminalize people and have dire, you know, consequences for the rest of their lives, we were able to get prosecutors saying, we're not going to waste our time with that. We don't think those are valid. We don't feel things are, you know, citizens need to be able to do that. And I never did understand the child support thing. How are you going to arrest a father, put him in jail, and then say you're supposed to be working to pay child support? That's dear to me because my dad did not pay child support for a while. Mm-hmm. It was out of retaliation for my mom, but still, we went without. So I got a special place in my heart for folks when it comes to child support. But arresting them to keep working, I don't see the value of that. So yeah. So we were able to get prosecutors to say we're not messing with those.
See, the effort that we have here that we call re-envisioning public safety is not isolated to the St. Louis, to the city of St. Louis. I mean, we're talking about 20 cities across the nation that people have sought to put in place alternatives to this quote unquote traditional criminal injustice model. Some of these laws are on the books. Go back to right after slavery and during Jim Crow, ordinances were put in place that are called like anti-vagrancy, anti-loitering, jaywalking, any excuse to pick up and put them into the enforced labor system, right? You know, the prison labor system, where you may end up on a chain gang or a road gang or or being rented out mm-hmm. as a prisoner, being rented out as a prisoner to some business somewhere. Okay. I have this going on in state and federal prisons where some of these correctional centers have, warehouses, factories on the grounds of prisons, and the residents of those facilities are put to work in these warehouses and factories. You know, assemble products, packaging products, work call centers. This is a way for these corporations to get, you know, local labor, mm-hmm. keep their overhead low, and profits high.
Yeah.
You know? Exactly. I mean, I found out that Microsoft was entering prison labor to package up software and ship it out. I was like, what?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
You know?
And they also are at different call centers. So these are folks that are getting your credit card information and you don't know it. So, yeah. So, yeah.
Right.
Yeah. So I think every time I think about it, cha-ching, because it's a dollar associated with everybody that they can get through those doors. And sometimes multiple things. And this is another thing that people don't understand, Johnson, is that when you go through the system, now the things that generally would get paid for by the state, even in terms of personal hygiene, you now are forced to buy that through the commissary. Now, in terms of you have to pay your visits to your probation officers, you now have to pay for your ankle bracelet. So those are the things that taxpayers thought that they were paying for. So are these people double dipping?
Certain services get contracted out by the system.
Mm-hmm.
And the ankle brace is a great example because the courts, the Missouri courts don't get a dime from that. That administrate the ankle bracelet, they're the ones getting paid. And they're getting paid by the so-called offender. The so-called to pay for the setup and monitoring of that bracelet, that ankle bracelet.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. I remember I came across a piece of paper on the street, and I picked it up, and it was a summary of charges for somebody who had just been released from custody, and the things that they had to pay for. They had to pay for their meals, while
mm-hmm.
They had to pay for the laundry of the jumpsuit that they were wearing while they were in custody.
Mm-hmm.
Basically you're paying for your own incarceration.
And don't be talking about the telephone, how high that is for people to stay
right.
connected to their loved ones. That's outsourced and it is terribly expensive.
They give you a tablet. as long as you be in your comment center, the tablet allows you to make calls or video calls and also be on the internet, and so that is monitored.
Right.
So sure. you have no privacy. You have no privacy whatsoever. Okay. When you're convicted of an offense, you do, the state strips you of your rights. Yeah. So you have no
right. Right. Right.
While you're incarcerated. But on the inside, you had refugees who said, "Well, no, we're still human beings, and this is still a constitutional system, and under the Constitution, we still have access to certain types of rights."
Mm-hmm.
Okay, and so that's been an internal fight, you know, from those up down, and that's why you're in the I want to call.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there were wide prison strikes, within the last couple of years.
Mm-hmm.
19 facilities, I remember at one point. Where the residents of those facilities were saying, you know, we're fed up. We're not going to take all of this oppression that you're heaping on us inside here, and nobody knows what's going on.
Right.
You know, out here, and we need to let people know what's going on. So that's a challenge.
That is a challenge. But I think one of the things that we meaning the Police Against Police Crime and Oppression, is to educate the citizens, first of all, their rights, because once you get sucked up into this, you don't need to be ignorant of what's getting ready to happen to you. And the other thing is, like, how do we organize people to fight for the reforms that we need on the way to abolition? And so for us, we've always had a relationship with the Public Safety Committee, because this is a committee of elected officials, your alder people, who are making decisions that go to the fort that affect public safety. So our relationship has been long and storied with them. And sometimes it's not, you know, a pleasant one, because we have to fight. We have to, like, you know, agitate. We have to struggle with these people to get them to understand what is going on. And so I think it's interesting that, you know, the public safety, they're, motto, in other words, is to, and I'm reading right from the website, is to work on policy that addresses effective means to reduce violent and quality of life crimes, to explore alternative response models to crisis, and to provide legislative oversight for respective city departments and enforce traffic safety. So just zero in on effective means. And that all responses is exactly where CAPCAR wants them to be. And so we've just got wind of there's going to be all these surveillance bills that are going to be coming up next week that we really want people to zero in on. So surveillance, I mean, that, you know, I just read that in terms of abolition. That's one of the things that no form of surveillance, because what we know is, and this is a sad thing about our community, Black community, we think that surveillance is going to help resolve and prevent our community. No. If you look at when those surveillance videos happen or shared, it is when somebody is involved in a crime against property, particularly white property or against a white body. So we really have to bring it on home for people. But do you know enough about what's going to be coming up next week with the surveillance bills that people should be watching?
A hearing at the Board of Public Safety Committee to get public comment, hopefully, on what is a surveillance proposed legislation. In a way, starting ShotSpot cameras and sensors that were set up all over the place and tied into the real-time surveillance center that's housed in the police department. As I guess they call it, a force multiplier for not having a so-called not having enough people on staff to patrol certain areas. begins that you're creating a high tech police state. Okay, invading a lot. I forgot what they called it. Stingray. That's the right thing. Whereas I think it was a system that was monitoring cell phone trend.
Mm-hmm.
And you could tell the stingray was in the area because then you would have difficulty maintaining a cell phone. You get a lot of drop calls, maybe some interference. Bottom line, agencies are using technology as a way to maintain occupational control of certain types of demographic and geographic areas. So, that, you know, really, okay, it's just another level of control.
And so those hearings next week is actually going to be 2 days of hearing, the 11th and the 12th. And people can get that information from CAPCOR's Facebook or from the Board of Alders. But what I think is helpful right now is the technology that allows us to participate, Johnson, in hearings, because a lot of them are now on Zoom. You can be listening to it. You don't have to be on the video. You can listen to it audio, and you know you can be at work, you can be on the treadmill and listening to what's going on, because these are people who are making decisions on your behalf. You elected them, and so they're supposed to be working for you all the time. They don't, and you need to know when that happens. So there's a bunch of those bills coming up, and I keep going back to, you know, the fact that folks say they are looking for effective ways of reducing crime. And I don't know that we have proven that effective. I know we don't think body cams are effective. We've had body cam and camera videos of police abuse since Rodney King. So CAPCOR never was really for body cams, and that was one of the demands that came out of Ferguson, like body cams, but people actually thought that that would help. But then they started finding out that police can turn those things off when they want to. They can lose them when they want to. They can edit them when they want to. So they're useless, really.
See, they use it in a tactical way to prove their side of the story.
For sure.
Okay. I mean, they can say, well, what you're seeing, you know, like if somebody released some video somewhere, and the police will say, well, that only shows part of what happened. It doesn't show the whole scenario of why police responded the way they did.
Yeah, that's exactly the defense that they used for Rodney King. They said, look at this video. Those gestures on his hand when he was attacking the officer, those were defensive. That brother was trying to protect his head and body from those nightsticks. And so, but they were able to convince an all-white jury that he was aggressive. Those hand gestures were striking out. And so what was the point of having that video? Because it didn't. We saw something completely different. We saw the real deal. And if it was not for some, bystander taking that, we never would have had the real deal about what happened to Rodney King. But we've been saying it all along, what happens in our community, and folks were like poo-pooing that. And so we're like, now we finally, in 1992, we finally got some answers and some proof that this is what happens, and it's not made that much difference. I mean, we saw George Floyd literally be killed in front of our very eyes, and not a whole lot has happened in terms of really significant changes in the way that police, police us. So, I do want us to talk about what people can expect when they come to the meeting, the CAPCOR meeting next Thursday. You want to talk about that?
Well, there'll be an up CAPCOR activities. We will have some things around the surveillance bill. We will review was reading Derek's book on abolition. And we'll be to help us other aspects of this work in putting in place a model that is re-envisioning public safety. And so anybody that has an interest in this to come on out. Plus, we'll have an update on happenings in the Sebigan Review Board, as well as I have a new commissioner for the Department of Sebigan Oversight. So I feel like we're going to have a full agenda.
And yeah, I think for me the important part is that folks will get a chance to look at the police budget. We need to make recommendations about where we see decreasing some of those line items and where it would go. So we definitely want people's views about that, because one of the things I'm seeing more of, Johnson, is the way it's playing out in terms of what people perceive crime. And so some of these folks who have mental health issues, and some of them chronic, that end up getting, charged and arrested for, serious physical crimes and assaults, end up having to be acquitted because of their mental health situation. And so to me, that means that there needs to be more funding and resources for people before they get to that stage. And we have not paid a lot of attention to mental health as it relates to crime. In fact, a lot of folks that are in prison today have mental health issues. A lot of folks there down at the city jail are either homeless or need some mental health resources. And so I think what we want to do is to look at how do we take the budget and align it with abolitionist principles. And so people get a chance to see in real time how we are thinking about that and how you do it. And this is an experiment here. That I have to say that we've not done that here in St. Louis, to look at a budget and say we are going to, because the budget process is going to probably start up in March, February. And we know that it ends, it's got to be approved by the end of June. And so we have a window there to make our case about what we think should happen with some of the ballooning budget of the police department.
Right. I don't know if people, institutional memory standpoint, the city and the state had resources to address mental issues. We had Malcolm Bliss Hospital. We had the state mental hospital on Arsenal. Psychiatric center on Del Mar. I'm sure how that's being administered now. I'm not sure if that's under the city or the state or if it's in private hands. I'm not sure. But what happened from a public policy standpoint is that government got out of the business of addressing those issues. Mission Creek allowed to fall under the purview of law enforcement and the criminal justice complex. In fact, issues would have been handled differently in the past. Now we have to go ahead and address it again and try to reallocate these resources so that there's some get people the help that they need.
Yeah, I mean, you just think about what happened to Sister Massey, who called out, for help and end up being shot on video and killed. And so, people are desperate. And when they call the police, and this is why we have a thing about when to call the police. I mean, that's part of the education process, to be careful every time you pick up that phone to call 911, because usually for us, the outcome is not good. It's just not.
I forget which city it's in, but they have a program that says, do not call the police.
Yeah, definitely going on. But, again, just like when you say defund the police, you have to be able to give people alternatives. If I don't call the police, who do I call? Or how do I resolve this situation in a nonviolent, peaceful way? And, there's resources for that people just don't know about. Yeah, for 2025, I am looking forward to, more input from folks who got some experience interacting with these various, entities and have been thinking about, like, what could be different. We want to hear your voices. We want to hear your experiences. So come out on a Thursday. We meet at Deaconess Center, 1000 North Vandevender, and that's at 6 o'clock. And, that's probably going to be the first of a couple of meetings that we'll need to digest all the information that we have and also to put it into some kind of plan or demands for the city. But the window's open right now, and we got a president coming in that's really getting ready to bring his authoritarian views and practices in. And so I think it's even more important now that we make some headway with that before he totally puts his 2025 plan into place, which is definitely going to be about control and domination and, fear and all those other negative things that we've heard him talk about on his campaign trail. So it's not looking pretty for us. And so I think point that we exercise our rights that we have now and our vision, our re-envisioning of public safety and pull that all together to really make a difference in how public safety gets implemented here in the city of St. Louis.
And closer to home, we have municipal elections coming up. We've got the mayor in March, and we have the general in April. Mm-hmm. And so, there's a mayoral race, there's a comptroller.
Mm-hmm.
I think the odd numbered wards are also going to be contested. So, from a public policy standpoint, we're in a position where we can, who's gonna actually, in the holding those of the power locally, and what is our stake in helping to move public policy in a type of direction, here in the city.
Yeah.
We also have, the current conflict between the governor and St. Louis County executive over who has the authority to replace Wesley Bell as prosecutor now that he's on his way to Capitol Hill as a congressman.
Mm-hmm.
You know? The right-wing forces out of Jefferson City are saying to a county that has its own charter that they don't necessarily have control over their governance.
Yeah. Yeah, and I think we're going to see more of that. I do believe more of that.
Right. And they also try to remove local control of the St. Louis Police Department.
Absolutely.
So after we so hard to get it.
Mm-hmm.
You know?
Yep. Yeah. So we got to do listeners, and we don't have the luxury or the privilege of sitting and complaining in 2025. And so what we're saying now is, we're getting ready for 2025, both the year and Project 2025 that the conservatives are going to be implementing. In fact, have already implemented some portions of it. But we cannot sit around and let our human and civil rights get trampled on and usurped because somebody thinks that they want to be a dictator. And that's a dictator both in the White House, mm-hmm. in the State House, and in any other houses that we are paying
right.
taxes to for our own oppression and repression. That's not going to work. So,
and it's critical while we are asking people, encouraging people to join us next Thursday at the Deaconess Center
mm-hmm.
For child well-being at 6 o'clock, as we explore these issues.
Absolutely. And I think, Johnson, because I already said that you are part of the Progressive Education, Emporium Education Center, that people can get Derica's book there, but what else can they get there? Because we're in the holiday season now, the Kwanzaa season.
Yes, we are. Well, we have a variety of items, not just books, but, if you want to the Kwanzaa, we have, materials you need so you can celebrate the seven principles. And we also are carrying clothes and incense and gift items, as well as a selection of holistic supplements and natural foods and beverages. Mm-hmm. And so So we've got quite a bit, available to bring your family into the harmonious, period of the Nguzo Saba celebration.
Absolutely.
The seven principles of blackness in Kwanzaa.
Right.
So please come on by. We have a sale going on right now. Holiday sale. It's 20% off on your purchases. We're here, we're actually going to be establishing, additional hours. So we'll be doing, Monday through Sunday through the end of the year, starting next Monday.
Okay. All right. So, you know, lots of things going on. Get that book, but when you get over there, you'll see that there's other things going on. You know, lots of different gifts for holiday and birthdays and everything else. So, Johnson, thank you for coming on. I know people heard some ching ching because you're actually at the bookstore. So thank you for joining us. And we'll see you next week at the Deaconess Foundation, 6 o'clock, unless you plan on coming to the Jimes with Justin's End of the Year party tonight. And that's up on my website, as is any of these other programs that you missed through the year. Thank you. This is Jamala Rogers, and I will see you on the battlefront.
All right.
Right now.